Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Ich warte seit Wochen auf diesen Tag und tanz vor Freude über den Asphalt, als wär's ein Rhythmus, als gäb's ein Lied, das mich immer weiter durch die Straßen zieht. Komm dir entgegen.
Hallo und welcome to Gegenpressing, the Bundesliga podcast from the Football Grad Network. My name is Manuel Fied, and this week we are previewing Germany's Eurogroup F. For the preview, I'm joined by CBS French correspondent Jonathan Johnson, Tom Condat from Portugal, and Hungarian football expert Thomas Mortimer. Let's just dive right into it, shall we? Yeah, joining me now is Jonathan Johnson from CBS Sport, France specialist. Jonathan, I feel like we've probably talked and chatted and all sorts of stuff on Twitter for many, many years now, but it's so good to actually hear your voice for the first time.
Tell me about it. Thanks a lot for having me on. I was delighted to get the invitation. And, you know, it's one of the greatest things about the international tournaments. It brings sort of us together, the football Twitter community, and you quite often, you know, get opportunities to meet and interact with people that you haven't done so with before. And, you know, obviously it's our turn this time.
Yeah, it is. And I'm looking forward to this tournament in... You know, it's an odd one for me a little bit because there was so much football this year. We spoke a little bit about this podcast before the podcast that there's so many games, but this little bit of a break now, it actually makes me look forward to this tournament a little bit. And I don't know how you feel because you've been very busy with covering the Champions League for CBS, Paris Saint-Germain, of course, went deep into tournaments twice in a row now. So are you ready to cover this tournament?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it makes a big difference when you're not going to be sort of on the front lines, so to speak, you know, following the tournament around, especially in a tournament like this, where it's not just in one country, you know, it's jumping between different venues. So in many ways, I'm grateful not to be, you know, doing too much on the traveling front. But no, there's definitely groups that I'm looking forward to seeing and specific matches. And, you know, I think you're right as well. You know, once you take a break of a couple of weeks, it brings that appetite back because, like you said, we've spent, you know, pretty much the entirety of the season with wall-to-wall football, you know, an important match being played somewhere every day, you know, pretty much for the entirety of the campaign. You know, there wasn't even any let-up over Christmas because, you know, as we know, the UK pushes on through for Boxing Day matches, that sort of stuff. But even the leagues with traditional winter breaks, like the Bundesliga, you know, had shortened breaks. So it's been a very odd season in many ways, or at least, you know, quite different for obvious reasons. But no, you're right. You know, I think that hunger, the appetite has finally come back just ahead of this Euros.
And for us, the two of us, you know, I'm covering Germany, you covering France. This group F is the last of the groups, but the first game of that group is the one between France and Germany. And is there a better way to kick off that group?
No, I don't think there is. You know, obviously it's quite a I wouldn't call it the group of death, but I know that many people are, you know, but it is obviously a very attractive group, and you've got the likes of Germany, Portugal, France in it, and Hungary as well. I mean, the interesting thing about Hungary is they're going to be playing a couple of their matches at home, and they're one of the only places where they're going to be able to have 100% capacity, which is going to make it, you know, quite difficult for the teams that have to go there, France being one of them, obviously. So, you know, I think that this group, the whole dynamic of it is very intriguing. And, you know, I don't think that there's any better way really for it to be kicked off than, you know, sort of two of the traditional players on this stage coming face to face. So I think France and Germany has the makings of being a very good way to kick off the group.
You know, as a German, as someone that supported and followed this team for a long time, I look at this France side and I see a giant of world football. And I was going to structure it with strengths and weaknesses, but talking about the strengths of this France side, how do you even define the strengths of the side that seems to be so complete, Jonathan?
It's true there are very few holes to pick in this France side at the moment. I mean, I'd say if I was being really picky, I'd say that France does have a few headaches in the fullback positions and slightly in midfield, because I don't think it's that obvious sort of who will be starting in the middle, aside from N'Golo Kanté and Paul Pogba. And, you know, obviously when you've got the likes of Benjamin Pavard and Lucas Hernandez playing as fullbacks when they started their careers as centre backs, you know, they're not quite the natural fit you perhaps want in the fullback positions. But, you know, obviously, any of the players that step into those roles are going to be of world class talent, and that's, you know, the greatest blessing that France have and that Didier Deschamps has. You know, I think he's probably the envy of all of the other coaches at this tournament because of not just the quality that he has available to him at senior level, but the, you know, the quality and depth that France have. You know, knowing that there's generations of talented players still coming through that's, you know, going to keep France competitive for the best part of the next 20 years. You know, and I think that's probably the most frightening proposition for so many international teams when they come up against France, because, you know, we've seen, you know, these kind of cycles over the years where some national teams have enjoyed their moments in the sun and then, you know, sort of faded away a little bit. We're seeing that at the moment towards the end of Joachim Löw's time with Germany. You know, we've also seen it with Spain as well. But France, when you look at the quality that's coming through in some of the age groups just below senior level, you know, it's almost like a never-ending conveyor belt of talent.
So the strength is its depth. Would you say that?
Yeah, I definitely say, you know, that France has fewer depth issues than pretty much anybody else in this competition. And I would also say that France has a very good mix of youth and experience, which is something that, you know, I think is very important for any successful national team. The only thing that I would say perhaps is that Didier Deschamps is perhaps guilty a little bit of being too loyal to some people, because there are some players, you know, who can barely justify their presence in the squad. You know, Olivier Giroud, as fantastic a character as he is and as good as he's been over the last couple of years, you know, he played an important but understated role in the 2018 World Cup success in Russia. Yet he's not really seen enough game time to justify his inclusion, which I think is partially why, you know, Deschamps and the French Football Federation were so keen to bring Karim Benzema back into the fold.
I want to get to Benzema in just a moment, but you kind of hinted already at a few of the weaknesses. Oliver Giroud, maybe one. You mentioned the fullbacks as well. Is that what worries you the most, or is there any other particular area where you look at this France side and like say, okay, well, look, they are very good, they are the favorites, but if you, Joachim Löw, you want to exploit this, is there any particular area that comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Hugo Lloris is not having the best phase of his career at the moment, particularly at club level. I think that Presnel Kimpembe has not been the same player since Maurizio Pochettino took over at Paris Saint-Germain. You know, and I think the third position in midfield, a lot is going to depend on who Deschamps selects for that, because obviously, you know, he brings along Corentin Tolisso to a lot of these international tournaments. And don't get me wrong, I think Tolisso is a fine player, but obviously he's had his struggles over the past couple of years, notably in terms of fitness with a couple of injuries. And if N'Golo Kanté was to pick up an injury, which we've seen at various times this season with Chelsea, then I think suddenly that French midfield loses control. I think the only position where France are really well stocked, especially you know, now that Benzema has been included, is in attack. Because even if you were to substitute off one of Griezmann, Mbappe, or Benzema, there are you know, more than adequate replacements to come off the bench. I mean, okay, if they were to miss multiple games, particularly in the group stage, that might be more problematic. But I think that France, you know, are very well stocked in attack. But if we were talking about a France without Benzema, expecting Giroud to lead the line, having barely played for Chelsea this season, that would obviously be more concerning from a French point of view.
I find the return of Karim Benzema very intriguing, John. He's a player who's obviously done a lot for Real Madrid over the last few years, and probably one of the big reasons why they actually managed to reach the semi-final of the Champions League, because I did not see them get that far. His return is a huge opportunity, I think, but it also comes with some risks, because he does change the dynamic of the dressing room, doesn't he? Or is this something where you say, okay, well, yeah, great, he's back. You know, France have something that Germany don't have, which is two number nines. But on the other hand, is this something that worries you? Or is Benzema's return just a massive benefit for this team?
I mean, I think Benzema's return is beneficial. I was a little concerned when the announcement was made that, you know, it did risk upsetting the chemistry in the squad. But I do think the way that the group has reacted since, you know, and also Benzema, the way that he's been talking publicly, I think all of that is very encouraging. And then obviously, as we say, I mean, it's a British saying, it's not a French saying, but the, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And, you know, when Benzema took to the pitch with France in the friendly against Wales, that was the proof that he can really combine well with this team. I mean, I wouldn't say that he's fitted in seamlessly, but it was probably about as painless an experience as you could wish to see. And I actually think that, you know, seeing him on the pitch has brought out something new in Mbappe and Griezmann, which, you know, I think is quite exciting for France coming into this international tournament. I actually wrote an article for a publication, the Modern Footballer, ahead of this tournament, about how Benzema's inclusion brings a bit of a spark back to the French national team. And I think it's something that they really needed, because having watched them since the 2018 World Cup success, particularly in World Cup qualifying so far, where they've drawn against Ukraine and then, you know, just about managed to scrape a couple of wins against the likes of Azerbaijan. It's not been particularly convincing so far. I mean, okay, you know, I know teams like Bosnia-Herzegovina and, you know, have some very talented players, but, you know, the way that France has been playing against, you know, some of these teams that are far below, you know, their level in terms of their respective squads is being quite underwhelming. So I think that France really needed something new, you know, something to give them a bit of a boost coming into this tournament. And Benzema coming off one of the best seasons of his career with Real Madrid, you know, is about as big a boost as you could find. So, you know, to see him come back, obviously he brings a lot on the pitch, but there were questions about what would happen away from the pitch. And so far, the early indications have been that he's actually been embraced very much so by the, you know, by the French squad, his teammates, and Deschamps himself. So that bodes well for France moving forward for this tournament.
I'm really looking forward to seeing Karim Benzema back in the squad, and I think it's going to be very intriguing having him there. Another player that I want to ask you about is N'Golo Kanté, and he was key for Chelsea winning the Champions League. Is he France's most important player?
I certainly think that he's one of the most important players. He's kind of like the glue that holds it all together, you know, because I think having him in that midfield enables the likes of Paul Pogba to thrive. And then depending on who Deschamps selects as sort of the third man in that rough 4-3-3, I think I've got a feeling it may well be Adrien Rabiot. You know, that gives them a lot more license to roam and get forward. You know, they're two players who don't really embrace the defensive side of the game. So I think, you know, that's why Conte enjoys so much success wherever he goes, because he plays in a role that's been unfashionable for years. You know, he makes it look so easy. You know, he does it all with a smile on his face, the smile that brightens up, you know, pretty much any squad that he walks into. You know, and it wasn't lost on me either that Thomas Tuchel was able to succeed with Chelsea in the Champions League, where he failed with PSG the season before. And he's found a player that he was sorely missing from his time in Paris. You know, Conte was the defensive midfielder that he was crying out for. You know, he was linked many times with Julian Weigl, who ended up moving to Benfica. But PSG never really satisfied his need for a defensive midfielder or in that Conte mold. And although there are very few players out there like him, you know, Conte is really one of those guys who you can point to and say, you know, he is key for club and country. And I think the biggest concern now for both Deschamps and Tuchel is finding ways to keep him fit, because it's such a taxing position and role that Conte plays within those two teams, that it's normal that as he gets older, he's going to pick up more and more injuries and have, you know, sort of physical concerns. And I think that's something that Deschamps is going to have to manage really well now coming into this Euro. And it's something that he's going to have to keep in mind as well ahead of the World Cup in 2022, because I think, you know, given his age, Conte is sort of heading towards, you know, this being one of his final international tournaments, because given the way, you know, that he's been impacted physically over the last couple of seasons, it doesn't seem like he's going to be the kind of guy who is, you know, still going sort of in his mid to late 30s.
Yeah, I think, again, I mean, if Germany wants anything out of that's going to be a player they want to shut down. Speaking of Germany, this is my second last question to you, and then we're pretty much through my question catalog there, Jonathan. What is France's perspective? How do they see this German national team?
I think the view of the German national team is it's a squad that has a lot of talent in it, you know, one sort of similarly equipped to the French national team. But I think there's a sense of confusion in France as to why Germany haven't moved on from Joachim Löw sooner than they have. You know, I think there's an expectation that Germany will become a major player once again when Hansi Flick takes over. But that while Joachim Löw is in charge, you know, this Germany side will, you know, sort of roll over and, you know, accept being beaten by their opponents. You know, when I looked at the squad, my feeling was that if the Germany national team could, you know, sort of get themselves into the mindset of being underdogs, you know, regardless of what their feelings towards Löw might be after, you know, so long in charge, if they were to sort of view this tournament as having nothing to lose, then that would make Germany extremely dangerous, given the, you know, the quality that they boast in that group. But whenever I've seen Germany, particularly over the last 12 to 18 months, it just seems like they almost can't wait, you know, for Löw's time in charge to be over. So I'm expecting that Germany will become more of a threat sort of towards the 2022 World Cup when Flick will be in charge. And I think that is a feeling that's, you know, pretty prevalent in France. There's a recognition, obviously, that there's a lot of talent there, you know, but also that there's been issues now for quite some time.
I think that's a feeling that's very much echoed in Germany as well for anyone following this team. My final question is, and I think the answer to that is quite easy, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless. What is France's expectations out of this tournament?
I think the obvious expectation is that they will get to the latter stages. But, if France, you know, react to, you know, being in a competitive tournament the way that they did in the World Cup, what we can expect, I guess, is a reasonably slow but consistent start. And then them sort of ramping up the pace as we hit the latter stages. And I think that the expectation would be sort of at least a semi-final. But really, you know, the aim will be to go all the way and win it. Obviously, they went to the final in 2016 on home soil, but got beaten by Portugal. Plenty was made about the fact that France got one day less rest than the Portuguese. You know, we'll never know if that would have made a big difference or not. But, you know, I think that France will feel that there's some unfinished business. And I think many of the members of the squad will feel that this is definitely a group capable of being world and European champions at the same time.
And they, of course, have done it before. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us. Where can people find you?
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. You can find me, it's probably best to get me on Twitter. So that's John_Legosip, JON_LEGOSSIP. And that's where you can find sort of all my bits and pieces for CBS and any other appearances that I might make on, you know, radio or podcast, that sort of thing.
Fantastic stuff. Thank you again. And yeah, we're going to move on to our next guest. Joining me now is another person that I've spent a lot of time talking to on various social media platforms and helping me to preview Portugal is Tom Kundert from Portugal. Tom, this is exciting. We finally get to talk in person.
Yeah, that's right. After so many years, yeah, so much communication, all written, of course. So yeah, it's good to hear your voice and it's going to be great talking to you about the Euros.
Tom, why are you the Portugal expert for this podcast?
I am the owner of Portugal.net, which is a website all about Portuguese football written in the English language. And so you find everything on there from domestic football, Portuguese clubs in European football, and of course the national team, you know, everything about the national team and the Portuguese footballers are playing abroad. A lot of them nowadays are doing very well, luckily. And I combine that also with some journalism for other publications, such as the World Soccer Magazine, who I'm a Portugal correspondent for. So, just kind of immersed myself in Portuguese football with a slight twist that it's all in the English language.
So just the man that we need. Tom, that's match day 2 of Group F that Germany will face this Portugal side, and they're the European champions. They are defending this title, maybe a title that they won in not really the most convincing fashion 4 years ago. I think they didn't win a regulation game until the semifinal, if I'm correct, right?
Correct.
But when you look at this team, so make no mistake, this is a very, very good team on paper. I mean, football isn't played on paper, and I think Germany's team, for example, on paper looks very good, but there's a lot of doubt of whether the national team coach is the right person. But when we look at this team, Tom, what are Portugal's biggest strengths?
Yeah, well, it's interesting there you talk about on paper, Manuel, because, you know, like you said, 4 years, well, 5 years ago now, isn't it, that Portugal won their first trophy. And if you asked 100 Portuguese football fans if this squad was stronger than the squad which won the European, the trophy, I'd guarantee you about 90 plus of them would say yes, no doubt about it. This squad is stronger, but that's the thing on paper. And talking about the squad is stronger player for player. This has got more talent. It's got especially attacking, offensive talent. You know, some fantastic players who are doing brilliant things all around Europe. But it's interesting what you just said there about Germany because, you know, Portugal, to be fair, haven't really translated that fantastic talent into a cohesive team as of yet. Only from time to time, I'd say, in the last two or three years, has that happened? So there's a kind of feeling in Portugal that, yes, there's a lot of optimism. Yes, we've got some supremely talented players. Yes, this squad is stronger than the 2016 squad, but is it a stronger team? Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
So when you say, okay, these are the actual strengths, where I feel there's a little bit of doubt there, Tom, about this team, because I mean, on paper, again, this is like every position, two or three players, maybe a little bit in defense where I say, okay, maybe there's some weaknesses there. Does this team have any weaknesses? And again, we're playing this game on paper right now. It's not like we're out there in the real life, but is that maybe where Germany can say, yeah, this is where this team can be vulnerable?
Oh yeah, I think without a doubt, that's what most opponents who play Portugal, that's what they're going to be looking to do, to attack not only the centre-backs, and especially, of course, there are actually two very good centre-backs. Of course, Ruben Dias has had an amazing season at Manchester City, and Pep, of course, as he showed against Juventus earlier this year, you know, he can really put it out still. But he is 38 years old. You know, those bones are beginning to creak a little bit. And I think perhaps a little bit less talked about maybe is Portugal's fullbacks, who are both, you know, fantastic players. One, of course, you'll know very well, Rafael Guerreiro, who plays at Borussia Dortmund and, you know, has for years, again, supremely talented player, but really good going forward, as is João Cancelo, the right back. But both of them, when they're playing against top opposition, at least in a Portugal shirt, you know, they have shown some weaknesses in the defensive side of their game. So, you know, that may be one area where opposition teams might look to, try and target Portugal. I think both their fullbacks perhaps aren't the strongest fullbacks.
When I look at this, the last few games, is it 4-2-3-1 Fernando Santos is going to opt for? Or do you think we can see any sort of experiments with this team?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because that's kind of been his go-to formation for a long time. He had William Carvalho and Danilo as the two at the base of the centre midfield, you know, the kind of double pivot. And that worked quite well, and that was quite settled. But it's changed a little bit in recent months. Why? First of all, William Carvalho, he's had a very disappointing season at Real Betis. You know, he kind of just fell out of favour, didn't play a lot of games or was only used as a sub. And even Danilo, he probably hasn't had his most consistent season. Of course, moved from Porto to PSG. He's done reasonably well, but he isn't an automatic starter for PSG, and he's actually played quite a few games at centre-back. So that obviously raises a lot of questions. You know, you don't really want two kind of central midfielders or the base of your midfield, two players who really aren't in very good form. And so he has changed a little bit to a bit more of a 4-3-3. I think we'll have, Bruno Fernandes, obviously, I think would be the attacking midfielder. And probably Danilo, I'd say, would be the more defensive midfielder. And then it's, you know, a lot of choice for the third midfielder. In recent games, you say that perhaps he's opting towards, Renato Sanches there. And then they probably use the three up front as Cristiano Ronaldo. Then you'll have Bernardo Silva, and you'll have Diogo Jota, probably, who's been really good whenever he's played for Portugal in the last year or so. So I suppose one illustration again of the strength in depth of this Portugal side is you've got a player like André Silva, who again you will know better than me, has just had an absolutely incredible season, can't stop scoring for Eintracht Frankfurt. And yet, it's a very good chance, I think, that he won't be starting.
There's a couple of names that you mentioned that I'm really curious about. And I didn't have it originally on my list, but now that you brought him up, is Renato Sanches, because he is a player that I know very well as well from his time at Bayern Munich. 5 years ago, I'm still on 2020 rather than 2021, but 5 years ago, Bayern Munich seemed like they had signed the golden boy when they signed him, and it never really happened for him in Munich. And I think we're still trying to figure out quite why. Went to Lille, it's a side that I follow closely because of my Canadian side, with Jonathan David being there as well. And he's done phenomenal there. Is Renato Sanchez one of those players where you say, look, he took a step back and he can be really, with the time that he had in Bayern, the time that he had now at Lille, can be a key player for this team?
Yeah, I think so, definitely, because he offers things which no other Portuguese players really do. You know, we talk about these fantastic attacking players which Portugal have got, you know, Bernardo Silva, João Félix, Ronaldo. And there a lot of those, even Ronaldo now, of course, has lost a lot of his pace and athleticism. They're kind of cerebral players, I think you can call them. You know, they're very intelligent footballers, as well as being, of course, supremely skillful footballers and, you know, a very good vision. But you wouldn't really call them particularly dynamic. And that's something which, you know, that's probably the word, is the one word, if you wanted to define Renato Sanchez, you'd probably say that, you know, dynamism, you know, energy, you know, kind of strength, nonstop, kind of buzzing about. And that's something which is really useful for Fernando Santos and Portugal, because, you know, that's sometimes Portugal could be a little bit pedestrian and a little bit predictable, but he really is neither of those two things. So, yeah, and in recent games, you know, he's only recently got right back into the Portugal setup. And, for instance, in the recent World Cup qualifiers, he was probably Portugal's best player. Him and Jota, I'd say, were probably Portugal's best players in those three games in March. And, you know, and even in this friendly, which I suppose you can't really read too much into friendlies, can you, pre-tournament friendlies? But, you know, again, he looked probably Portugal's best player in a friendly against Spain on Friday. So, yeah, and like you said, coming off a fantastic season. So, his confidence will be sky high. And, yeah, looking at his career, I think most people can kind of, it's quite easy to identify now that move to Bayern Munich was just too soon, you know, too early in his career. He'd had a fantastic debut season. He hadn't even had a full season at Benfica when Bayern Munich bought him, you know, so it was a bit of a surprise, but, you know, he'd looked brilliant in that season. And then, of course, he was very good in Euro 2016. So you can kind of understand Bayern Munich getting in there before anyone else did, or before his price became even more expensive than it was. But yeah, it didn't really work out for him there, did it? I think, you know, the competition was just so fierce. He was a very good player, but he was still raw. And, you know, that side was just Rolls Royces, weren't they? all throughout that midfield, you know, they were just basically lots of the best midfielders in the world were in that side. And so perhaps shouldn't have been such a surprise that he struggled to make an impact. And of course, he had a few problems with injuries and things. And then, yeah, unfortunately, just didn't work out for him. But yeah, he's back on track. And of course, the fact that he was so young when he did burst onto the scene kind of makes people forget that he's still very young. You know, he's 22, I think, 22 or 23.
23.
So, yeah, 23. Yeah. So, you know, he's still really, if you're thinking about it, it's, you know, quite near the start of his career, or, you know, in theory, the next 5-6 years will be the best years of his career if he, you know, follows a kind of normal football trajectory. And so, yeah, you know, I think it'd be very exciting to see him at this tournament. And I think a lot of Portugal fans, and most importantly, I think Fernando Santos, the coach, really expect him to play a big part in this tournament.
Maybe my final thoughts on Renato Sanchez. Maybe the player he is now is actually the player that Bayern Munich need for next year. But that's a different story for a different podcast. I don't want to start any transfer rumors here. I want to talk about Cristiano Ronaldo, because he is a guy who, phenomenal career, so many years at the very top of football. With the season he had with Juventus in mind, you do get the sense now he is coming to an end at some point soon. How important is he still for this team? And how big of a factor could it be that, you know, they almost over rely on him considering all the other talent that they have available?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say they over rely on him now, because that was definitely a big problem for Portugal for many years. They did certainly over rely on him. I think it's more, I know your question, and it's a good question. I know the gist of your question. I think the word isn't perhaps over-rely, it's perhaps over-focus on him, which, you know, that is definitely something which has been a problem for Portugal. You know, that has been a problem for Portugal. You know, players are kind of in awe of him, and it's almost understandable. You know, you look at what he's done. We're talking about the greatest Portuguese footballer of all time, one of the greatest footballers of all time, full stop. And so it's kind of understandable that, you know, players are a little bit in awe of him. And then, of course, his attitude is so ambitious, is so driven, that can kind of translate into what can be perceived as a little bit of a, you know, kind of drawing a lot of attention to him, always calling for the ball, always wanting the focus again to be on him, because he always wants to be the one who, you know, not in a bad way, he just thinks that he's you know, he's the best person to you know, to take Portugal forward. Now, I think this is slightly different now, first of all, because you got players like Bruno Fernandes, you got players like Bernardo Silva, you got players, you know, like even João Félix, who's, you know, just won the Spanish championship, who players who are very successful in their own right. And players who are confident in their own ability, and so I don't think there's this. I don't think there's so much in awe of him as they were, or how can I put this? That, you know, the respect. There's certainly as much. You know, there's a lot of awe and respect for him for what he's done in his career. But they, you know, I think if it comes to it, people, these players will be prepared to take on responsibility themselves. And I think that makes a big difference. And now there's a very interesting discussion going on in Portugal now. Quite often, quite a lot of people, and I'd say more and more as time goes on, are suggesting something which just about a year ago maybe would be hearsay, which would be Portugal actually played better without Cristiano Ronaldo. And that has caused, you know, quite a lot of controversy, or quite a lot of column inches, you can say, to be written. I suppose the thing to say there, the most important man, again, in respect to this, is Fernando Santos. And Fernando Santos has made it absolutely clear that, for him, he believes that Cristiano Ronaldo is still the best player in the world. At least that's what he says. And he'll still be, you know, the first. He said this team cannot possibly be any stronger without Cristiano Ronaldo in it. So Ronaldo will start every single game, you know, unless maybe Portugal are in a position where they can rest him. But if not, he'll start every single game, and he will be the focal point of their attack. And so, yeah, he has slowed down a little bit, of course. It's going to be interesting. Cristiano Ronaldo slowing down is a concept which has been talked about time and time again. But I mean, even this season, Manuel, you know, he's slowed down. He scored 36 goals.
Yeah.
In Italy, you know, so
it's context matters, right?
Yeah, exactly. If it was any other player who scored 36 goals, you know, you'd just say, "Wow, you know, who is this?" And, you know, but even taking away the penalties or whatever, that's you know, he's still a fantastic and a top performer. And of course, now you could argue that he's finally got a supporting cast who, you know, the kind of caliber of player surrounds him who he really should have had and he hasn't had for many years at Portugal. So that, of course, will help them, because it's a mutual thing. They'll help them because Ronaldo will obviously, you know, draw a lot of attention. And but also, you know, on the other side of the coin, you know, defenders will be focusing on trying to stop, you know, Bernardo Silva trying to stop Bruno Fernandes, and so perhaps Ronaldo would have a little bit more space than he has had previously. So yeah, sorry for such a long-winded answer, but to the long and short of it is, yeah, Cristiano Ronaldo is still a hugely important part of this Portugal side.
Well, that brings me to my final question, Tom. How is the Germany team seen in Portugal?
Yeah, well, I think Germany, you know, it's the we had a little sample of it yesterday in the European under-21 final. they always are a team which are hugely respected in Portugal, mainly because they almost always beat Portugal, of course. Historically, Portugal have got a terrible record against Germany. I think the only good result that I can remember was, of course, the Euro 2000 championship, where Portugal actually pulled off a bit of a surprise victory in that one. But that was a surprisingly weak, I'd say, historically very unusually weak Germany side, of course. And there, even if perhaps this Germany side can't be compared to the great sides, I think that's fair to say, of the past, it's still very, very strong. And Germany, as ever, they seem to have this ability to, it doesn't really matter who the individuals are. They always, as a collective, they're always really, really tough to beat, really strong. And I also do think you see this a lot also in club football when Portuguese sides play against German sides. Portuguese sides have got an atrocious record against German sides in club football. And I think a lot of it has to do with physicality because, you know, the German game is, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I think it's a cliche which has some truth to it, is based a lot on, you know, power and strength and physical strength. Although, of course, you know, especially in recent years, Germany have had some fantastically technical players. But I think that's one threat or one aspect of the game which Portuguese people are worried about. Because, of course, you look at Portugal's best players, you know, Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes, João Félix, players like that, even Diogo Jota, they're all players who are kind of quite slight, not exactly built, you know, very strongly. And so there is a bit of a worry that perhaps the German side might outmuscle them or overpower them physically, which is precisely what happened in the under-21 final yesterday between Germany and Portugal. So, yeah, you know, that's, I think, Portugal will be hoping, obviously, for a very good result, in the first game against Hungary, so they can kind of go into that game against Germany, with perhaps a bit of a lead on Germany, depending what Germany do against France, or perhaps a bit less pressure on them. And then I'd expect them to possibly play on the break, especially, of course, as it would be in Munich, so it'd be like playing in an away game. So, it should be a fantastic occasion. But, no doubt about it, Portugal are very, very wary of this German side.
Well, that concludes this part. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And if people want to find you, where can they find you?
Well, thanks, Manuel. Always enjoy, communicating with you. I was going to say chatting to you, but this is the first time. Yeah, always good, exchanging ideas with you. The best place to find me is at Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Portugal1, so that's PORTUGOAL, and then one, the number one, Portugal1. So if you just go there, then all my journalism work and all my thoughts about Portuguese football will be in that one place.
And it's a fantastic place for Portuguese football. I've my go-to for Portuguese football for many, many years. If you haven't followed Tom yet, please do. If you haven't checked out his blog yet or his site, please do. It's fantastic work. Well, thanks again, Tom. Really appreciated this. I'm now joined by Thomas Mortimer to preview Hungary. Thomas, for people who don't know you, shame on them. Tell us how you became the expert on Hungarian football.
Yes, it's kind of a weird story, to be honest. I started getting into Hungarian football when I was basically about 10 years old, maybe even younger than that. So my grandparents are Hungarian. I'm British. I grew up in the UK. But my grandparents kind of brought me up a lot. I spent a lot of time with them when I was a young age. And my granddad, being a massive football fan, basically indoctrinated me about Hungarian football, especially the Marti Magyars. He used to tell me about Puskás all the time. Like, I knew pretty much the Marti Magyar team off by heart when I was probably like 12 or 13 years old. I used to play kind of with the Hungarian teams on Football Manager, and I used to watch a lot of NB1 as well when I was growing up. Like, my granddad lived in the UK and had a Hungarian TV installed into his TV, so I used to watch a lot of it. So I was kind of basically grew up, and I knew as much about Hungarian football as I did about English football. And then when I got to about 16, 17, I looked for people who were writing about Hungarian football in English, and literally no one was. So I thought, and I never was a writer or anything like that before. And I just thought, I'll just take it on myself. I was obsessed with football anyway, and especially Hungarian football at that point. And there was just kind of a niche that needed to be broken into, I guess, for someone. And I just happened to be that person. So that was probably about 13 years ago now. And yeah, ever since I've been writing about Hungarian football, and for a number of publications across Europe, and also have our own podcast, which is called Magyar Foci Live, where we've interviewed people like Gábor Kiuri, Peter Vermees down the years. So it kind of sounds weird when I just say, oh, I'm a Hungarian football writer with this British accent, but there is a kind of a logical backstory to it, I guess.
I can attest from following you that you are the expert, without a doubt. I mean, following you for a long time, and hearing this background story, you're just the person that we need to break down this Hungary team for us that possibly we don't know very much about. For Germany supporters listening to this podcast, right? And this is a Group F preview, Germany's Group F. When you look at this team, Thomas, what are this team's strengths?
I think more than anything, it's the togetherness and the collective. A lot of international teams sometimes look like they are thrown together and they're just kind of a bunch of individuals thrown onto the pitch. And that's never an accusation that you can throw at this Hungarian team. And I think more than anything, that's what makes them so strong. They pretty much play like a club side. Because if you look at the team on paper, it's really not impressive at all. Like, one of our better players, one of our best players for probably 5 years now, is Aldon Nagy, who is at Bristol City, and he doesn't even get into the first team there every week. But look at him playing on the international level, and he's just a completely different player. He's almost like the Hungarian David Healy. Like, when David Healy was scoring all those goals, like, he was doing absolutely nothing at club level, and then he scored a hat-trick against Spain. Like, I guess there are these random players who just can turn it on at international level, or maybe they just feel a little bit more confident. They feel they are used better on international level. And that is kind of our whole team in general, really. Like, there are a few standouts. Szoboszlai would have, of course, been one of the standouts. Willy Orban, as you guys, I mean, I guess everyone I'm going to say almost now is has a bit of a German relation. Gulácsi as well, as you guys would know, in Germany, is obviously one of our better players. And we also have Attila Szalai, who's at Fenerbahce, who's a really good defender. But the rest of that is kind of much of a muchness. And it's just the way that they play together is something really special. And I think these games also are not the Euros games, but international games in general, are the biggest games that these guys play. You look to the players who play in Slovakia and Cyprus, even like the players in the lower Bundesliga, like Adam Szalai and Roland Szalai. These games are still massive for them. That these games are the biggest games that they'll play all season, pretty much. So that helps in qualifying and in Nations League games. And I think it will help in this tournament as well, because from what I've heard from, especially maybe Germany, they're in a bit ramshackle at the moment. They've not been in great form, and that is not an accusation. Again, you can throw at Hungary. They've been in good form, and they are together on the pitch, and they've been together for probably 2 weeks longer than most other national teams as well. So they breed this togetherness and they breed this tactical nous that not a lot of nations do. So I think that's what makes them so dangerous and what makes them so good, despite, like I say, their team on paper not being that great.
We have to speak about, you know, some of the things that may be going to be problematic for Hungary. And Dominik Szoboszlai, as you hinted, is out. I feel like this is he's a player who we've all been anticipating to finally see arrive in Germany, and we didn't get to see him at all, which is really sad because, you know, I mean, I've been to Salzburg a few times to see him play there, and then he arrives in Leipzig, right? And we're all looking forward to having this new sensation in the Bundesliga, and he never plays, and then now he's out for the Euros as well. He would have been one of the biggest stars of the tournament period, not just for the Hungarian national team. How big is his loss, and can it be compensated?
It is really huge. Hungary have actually done well without him recently, and the Poland game, which was our last proper qualifier. We played Andorra and San Marino after that, but our last proper qualifier, where he didn't play, and we had the guy called Zsolt Kolmár, who also used to be at Leipzig, didn't really make much of an impact there, and he's now back in Slovakia. He was kind of the light for light replacement, and again, he's one of those players in the international stage. He's just lit it up, and he's had a really, really good season in Slovakia as well. But then he got injured in the Andorra game, and he's out. So the Szoboszlai loss is massive in itself. But then our light-for-light replacement is also out. So we're down to our third choice, number eight, essentially. So it's a huge loss. But it's kind of it's a mental loss as well. Like that, there's such high hopes for him, as you kind of intimated there. And even like Viktor Orban came out and was having his say on the fact that he wasn't in the squad. So like, I think it's going to deflate the team massively, even as much as how much it'll affect on the pitch. On the pitch, he is one of the few players that we have in the squad it's hard to say he's world-class, but he already has a lot of world-class moments, and none of our players have that potential. Like his goal against Iceland was a world-class moment. You've seen some of his goals in the Champions League, world-class moments. I think the one he scored in the first group game, I can't remember the team who it was, but for Salzburg, he scored an absolute screamer. And he scores loads of goals like that. And he's that player who can score from nothing, create something from nothing. And not having him in the team, especially when you're playing against sides where you're not going to have much of the ball and you need to make the most of every chance you have, not to have him in the side is a huge, huge blow. Because you just think, where if we go 1-0 down, where is anything like that going to come from? You're almost relying on a set piece, in fact, potentially, or a moment of magic from someone else, or a little bit of luck. But the moment of magic, there's not many players you can really point to who can create that. And Szoboszlai was the man who was going to be delivering that. So you can't even speak about how big of a loss it is. I still don't think it's the end of the world, but it is. Yeah, I think also it's just really sad for him because he was the man who, like I say, that goal against Iceland in the last minute, he was the man who took Hungary to the European Championships, and for him to miss out is super sad as well, because these moments don't come around that often either for the Hungary national team. Like, this is only the second tournament we've had in 35 years, and to play them with games at home at a European Championship as well, super, super disappointing for him. I'm just hoping he comes back from it strong.
So how do you replace him then? And is that player then automatically also the player to watch for Hungary?
I think there's not going to be a systematic change or anything like that. Hungary will kind of stick to their formation, which is a 5-3-2. And yeah, like I say, Szoboszlai was the eight in that midfield three. I think the like-for-like replacement is going to be probably Daniel Gosdog. It could potentially be David Shige or Loic Nago. If it's Shige, Klein Heisler will turn into the eight and Shige will drop back a little bit in that midfield. If it's Nago, they might like alternate, almost like play alternating eights with Klein Heisler and Nago. There's just no comparison though between the guys. Like I say, if it was Joel Coleman, I know not many people probably have heard of him, but he was playing magnificently for Hungary, and he has been a superstar. But Gosdog has barely played outside of Hungary. He's played, I think, a couple of international games, not many at all. He's played some Hungary under 21 games, and he's only just moved to the MLS. And he's not particularly been great when he has played on the international level. So I think it would be difficult to play him from the start. David Shige has played for Ferencváros in the Champions League this season, and he's played a few more games at international level, though he's more of a workhorse than a player who's great on the ball. And then Loic Nago is a bit of a different one. Like he's actually French. He's played in Hungary for, about 6 years, 6 or 7 years now. He's only just changed nationality. And he's someone who's really, really good on the ball and has international experience. Played for French under 19 and under 20 sides. And he will offer something a little bit different in that midfield. But whoever replaces him out of those three is just not comparable.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm interested. I actually heard you talk about Gosdog because, of course, he's got his transfer to the Philadelphia Union, and we have a lot of American listeners to this podcast, so they will have picked up their ears right there. And then gone over, quite a lot here already, but Hungary is one of those few places at this tournament where we can expect full crowds in the stadium, right? They have two home games. The third game they will be playing in Germany, with Germany having all three home games. With that in mind, first of all, we kind of spoke about this ahead of the podcast. Vaccination rates in Hungary are actually extremely high. You alluded to this. With vaccination rates being high and stadium at full capacity, what are the expectations then with two home games at this tournament in front of a full crowd? Is this something where you say, okay, well, maybe there is a shot even to get out of this group, or is that too much?
I honestly think there would have been a genuine shot if Szoboszlai had been fit and match fit. I think that was always going to be the difference anyway. Like you said, he didn't play at all this season in Germany, so whatever Szoboszlai we would have had, it wouldn't have been the greatest, as good as he could have been. I think that would have, and but with whatever type of Szoboszlai, I think there would have been not expectation, but potential that we could get through the group. Now, I just don't think so. I think Hungarian fans will just be happy to be competitive more than anything. I think if Hungary did end up getting battered by everyone, that would be seen as, yeah, that's not good enough. But I don't think if Hungary were competitive in every game and lost every game, I don't think that would be seen as a bad tournament at all. Like, Hungarian fans are very realistic. We do perform above our expectations and our quality a lot. Like in qualification, we ended up finishing fourth in the group, but we were in a tough group with Slovakia, Wales and Croatia, and we ended up beating Croatia and Wales at home. And that's just kind of a sign of what Hungary are. In the Nations League last year, we beat Turkey, Serbia and Russia. We didn't beat Russia, but we finished above them in the group. And then we drew against Poland last time out, and we beat Iceland to qualify for this tournament. So Hungary always, like all of those teams, I would say, Hungary are worse than on paper. So Hungary are always playing above themselves. And I don't think that's kind of created a an arrogance or a kind of a feeling that Hungary are better than, Hungarian fans think they're better than they are. I think that Hungarian fans are still very realistic regarding their chances. And I feel that probably Hungary fans fancy themselves potentially in that first game against Portugal, especially as Hungary got a point off them in at the last Euros as well. I think France, most people see that as a really, really tough game just because their team is so good and they're coming off the back of a World Cup win as well. I think Germany, they kind of potentially see a chance there just because Germany, like I say, aren't in great form. But playing away in that game isn't easy. And I think Germany always have that aura around them at international level, despite the troubles that you guys may have had, that they are, I mean, it's just the kind of their history. They always are known for turning up at big tournaments, well, more often than not anyway. So I wouldn't say there are any expectations apart from being competitive, really. If Hungary got a couple of points, I think Hungarian fans would be delighted with that, to be honest.
So that gets me to my final question then. How is the German team seen in Hungary? And you kind of already alluded to it, but I'm really curious what Hungary's perspective is on this German national team.
I think German football in Hungary has always been, I almost feel like, the most respected out of any nation. I mean, I think it's maybe just that our historic ties to Germany throughout history. I mean, we go back to World War One and we go back to World War Two and stuff. Like, there was always like that, like, collectiveness, I guess. Like, we always kind of have had that affiliation to Germany, and obviously being part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War One, and obviously during World War One. I think that creates more of affinity with the Germanic nations. So I think that despite Hungary being under communism, that has been retained. And in Hungary, like, German football, yeah, is just seen as being probably the elite. And maybe that's why so many Hungarians go to the Bundesliga as well. I'm not quite sure of the reason for that, but if you look at our squads, look at all the Hungarian players, really, they who play in the big leagues, they all play in Germany. Gulácsi, Orbán, Zolai, Szalai, Szoboszlai as well now. And I think there's a little bit of stylistic similarities between the way that the Hungarian league is and the German league. German football is always massively respected. But right now, to be honest, despite Germany's bad form, they are seen as being, just the elite out there. And you look at just their players on paper, and having Thomas Müller back is I feel like a huge blow to Hungary. Just, I think more just his experience and his mentality more than anything. But I think Hungarians are smart, and they do know that there is a realistic, potentially chance that we could get a result out of this game. I think if it was at home, you'd fancy Hungary a lot more. But I think that game being away and the last group game of the group, I think that makes it a lot tougher as well, because that means that Germany are very, very likely going to be in a position where they need to win that game to go through, especially considering their first two games. So I think there's kind of a little bit of optimism, but I think there's a lot of fear, and just more than anything, a lot of respect for what Germany are as a footballing nation, really.
Well, that pretty much sums it up for me. Tom, where can people find you?
So I'm on Twitter at Tom Ash Mortimer. That's Tom Ash without a H and with a Z. You can find our podcast at HungarianFootball.com.
Fantastic stuff. And yeah, please, if you listen to this podcast, head over there, check it out, give Thomas a follow. And yeah, thanks again for doing this. And that's it. That wraps up our podcast. We'll be back soon doing more Euro stuff this year. And until then, auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.